In Warbirds on the fly today, Jay Munchie. You're listening to EA Radio. We are having a nice weather day down here in the reenactors area called Miller Field. I'm joined by Kevin Wisniewski, who is the commander, and he has brought over a fellow named Bob Bleckley. Did I pronounce that right?
Blecky.
All right. Bob, you are with the 401st Glider Infantry. Tell us about that organization and what you represent.
Okay, what we're here to portray is the glider infantry regiments of the airborne divisions. And most people think airborne, they think paratroopers. But one out of three regiments were brought in by gliders. That was true from D-Day forward. So we're here to go ahead and show that version of the airborne experience.
Uh-huh. And what typically did they do?
Well, their combat role would be no different from any other soldier. In fact, the glider infantry were different from the paratroopers in not being volunteers. They were told that they were now glider infantry and wore the same equipment, the same weapons, same gear as the regular leg infantry, which created quite a competitive problem with the paratroops, who were not only specially equipped, but received a lot of extra pay.
A little bonus.
If you're here later, you'll probably hear a song about the differences between the two groups.
So they were a little bit combative, huh?
There's a rivalry between the paratroopers and the glider infantry inside the same
competition.
Division.
Competition. Competitive.
More like a competition, yeah. Well we were just talking about this. They were young, so they were just out of high school typically, right? So
That's true. Yeah, although I will say this for the record, the 401st had the highest combat readiness effectiveness rating before D-Day of any of the regiments in the 101st. Just want to make sure we got that.
Get that cleared up.
Not to those veterans.
Do you know anybody? Is anybody representing the original 401st Glider Infantry? Have they stopped by here? Have you talked to anybody that...
I have not met any here at Oshkosh, but we have run across them in other places, and we've gone and visited some of them at home. There was one that passed a few years ago, Robert Bowen, who was a staff sergeant in Charlie Company, 401st Glider Infantry, who was a very gracious gentleman, invited us into his home, spent a couple of hours with us, showing us his equipment, telling his stories, and sharing his time and his talent with us, which is fantastic.
Yeah, I should say that we've been spending years talking to these veterans, and that's part of our goal, is to pass these stories on, once these guys go to the better place, and keep those stories alive.
Which is the whole purpose of...
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Do you find it hard to... what do you do for a living?
I work in a project management organization for a gas and electric utility.
So it must be interesting, most of us here are volunteers at EAA for this 1 week out of the year, if not more. Is it hard for you to separate your life, like to arrive at this place called Miller Field, and become somebody who you're really not?
Well, I think all of us carry a little bit of our persona with us day to day. You can't become something that's completely alien from you. However, I think once you arrive and once you put on the uniform, now it's 1943.
Yeah, I know for myself, for briefings, I kind of go into character sometimes. I talk with a little bit more authority, and I kind of a little bit more bossy than normal, but we get ourselves immersed in it, like Bob just said.
Well, that's and we expect and we give proper military courtesy throughout the camp. You'll see that demonstrated. So there's an expectation that once you show up and play your part, you will perform appropriate to your role.
Now, when you go in the military, and I was in the Air Force, when you go in the military, they take you to basic training and they teach you these things, military courtesy, military law, all the things that you need to function as a military member. How do you handle that here? If you get somebody new who's not been in the military, how do you present them with the proper etiquette and the rules?
I think there's probably a two-part answer, because we are a collection of reenactor groups. Each of them is responsible for the authenticity and the behaviors of their troops. However, as being part of the Warbirds Living History Group together, then Kevin lays out some additional standards that we have to maintain as part of this collective effort.
And if they don't have military background, we actually train them here.
You do train them, just like basic training.
We take people out once a year and do our School of the Soldier just to bring everybody up to snuff. Now, we've got people who are veterans and civilians in the outfit, and so it's important for, obviously, folks with no military background to understand that and be able to respond appropriately. And we also have to have people who are current serving military understand the 1940s version of the commands and the signals and courtesies and et cetera, and insignia placement, the whole routine.
Yeah, that leads up to a good question. How has it changed? How is it different?
There's just a thousand little ways.
Here, you mean, how's it changed?
No, I mean from World War II to now, to present day military.
I would say, I mean, there's a lot of things that have changed, but I mean, it's still your basic military etiquette and the training. Training might be different to fit the needs of today, but I mean, you're still taking the basic. Yeah. Steps through your courses. Yeah.
And if you're going to do it, you know, so if you have a combat impression like we do, some of the troop movements are different. The expectations of how you move from the assembly area to the front lines are going to be different. Some of the formations and hand signals are different. And we try to get people to use period-appropriate language. If you're going to use slang, better use 1940s slang.
And I was going to say, too,
and
that
British is a whole different deal.
That's
all slang.
Completely different.
You'll get them next. But a lot of people don't realize, too, that if you become involved in living history and reenacting, that we have events that the public are not invited to. And these events are geared toward training and giving you a complete experience of what these veterans might have gone through out in the field. And sometimes those get kind of intense, and you get a feeling once in a while that's, oh, my God, I just
yesterday when I was over here talking to you, I noticed the USO gals over here were cooking. And their style of cooking was quite foreign. I mean, different.
It's they completely immerse themselves down to the cooking in the morning. They do their hair. They prepare themselves completely as the ladies would have back in 1943.
Now, did they actually have women at Miller Field?
The only time there would have been a woman at Miller Field is if she was an adjutant to someone in the high brass, or possibly a USO coming through.
A USO. We're going to talk to them
sure.
in a later segment, so we can cover that then. But it's just interesting to me how into the role you folks get here, and it just, for somebody outside the living reenactment area to see that, it's just interesting.
The more we get into it, the more that reflects to the public, and it's more believable to the public.
Now, you have a tour, don't you? Is there a tram tour from Warbirds that comes through?
Well, there's a tram tour that comes through on a daily basis, and they kind of show the people what we do, but we don't really do anything on the tram. The only time we move out of the camp is if we're doing photo opportunities with different aircraft, or for requested for a presentation so people can see what the soldiers look like.
So do you participate in the Veterans Parade on Friday as in your old reenactment uniforms?
Yeah, typically we supply the color guard for that, one for with a member for each branch of service. Because many of the folks here don't do just one, we refer to this as our impression, one uniform version. There are people who have multiple uniforms for multiple branches of service, sometimes for multiple time periods.
Well, and let's hit on that for a moment, because a lot of younger people who may be watching or listening don't know how things have changed. And that is one thing that has changed since World War II, is the services. So now we have the Air Force, the Army, the Marines, the Navy, and the Coast Guard. Back then, it wasn't that way.
It was not with the Air Force. When Avon started coming into the military, the Navy was interested and the Army was interested. And at that time, they formed a branch called the Army Air Corps. And so they were directly part of the Army proper. And it wasn't until 1946, after World War II, that they decided that the Air Force should have their own branch. And that's when the United States Air Force came into being, although Army Aviation continues till today. Back then, those were together.
Was Miller Field located somewhere, or is it just representing that fellow named Miller?
There was a Miller Field, but for us, it represents the veteran.
And it would have been in Great Britain, right?
No, he was actually stationed in the Pacific Theater.
Oh.
He was fighting the Japanese with B-25s. And what we're representing here is Italy, the Mediterranean.
Like up in the northern, like, oh, down south.
Well, we would have started in southern Italy and worked our way up while the battle for Europe was going on at the same time.
So tell us a little bit more about the glider infantry before we take the next break here.
Well, this is something that was only used during World War II. The Germans really shocked the world, not just with the Blitzkrieg, but by using glider-borne troops to assault a Belgian fortress and take it out with a very small contingent of people. It really got everybody's attention, and we wanted to get into the game, even though we were still, as a country, sitting on the sidelines at that point. And began to build, but Americans do things big. Instead of small combat groups, we wanted airborne divisions. And part of that was glider regiments. Now, the thinking is, at least on paper, makes a lot of sense. If I have paratroops, I'm dropping paratroopers. They're dropping individually. They're dropping with their equipment largely disassembled. They have to find each other. They have to find their gear. They have to put it together. They have to find their leadership, and then they're combat effective.
That sounds like a process.
If I have an intact rifle squad in a glider, it lands, we kick out the door, we're ready to fight.
Let's talk about the glider. I mean, we're at Oshkosh. Everyone's here for pretty much for airplanes, same reason. Tell us about this type of glider. Well, what were we operating?
The primary U.S. combat glider was the Waco CG-4. That was actually made, they didn't make but a few of them themselves. It was license built by many manufacturers. I think Henry Ford made more Waco gliders than Waco or anybody else did, not surprisingly. It's an 84-foot wingspan, a 48-foot fuselage. It was big enough to drive a Jeep loaded with the men in the seats into the fuselage of the glider. It could carry a full rifle squad. It could carry a Jeep and a trailer. It could carry skids of ammo. It could carry a 37-millimeter anti-tank gun and ammunition, a 75-millimeter pack howitzer and ammunition.
Wow.
In the Pacific, in the China-Burma-India theater, they used them to evac casualties. By the snatch method. Imagine, if you will, a pair of football goalposts with a lanyard stretched across, and they're tensioned so that they fall outwards.
Like a slingshot.
C-47 comes up behind. You know, the tow rope is attached to that lanyard.
Oh, okay.
C-47 comes up behind with a hook, catches it, the poles fall open. There's a brake drum inside the C-47 that starts to reel out cable, and as they put the brake on, it snatches that glider up into the air so they could evac casualties by glider.
Wow, that would be cool to watch.
That would be, folks get on YouTube, you can find it. There's pictures, they really did that.
We're not going to see you reenact that today?
We are not. There are no airworthy CG-4 gliders in the world.
What a shame.
But we have C-47s.
We do.
We can put a hook
do.
On you.
Yeah, thanks.
Now, that would be awesome, awesome reenactment, if you could do that. So I didn't even realize that gliders that big even existed, and a lot of people probably
Well, people
don't.
Think glider, they think sailplanes and riding thermals. You're talking about a cargo box with wings. And once you pull the handle and that tow rope separates, you've got pretty much time for a big 180, and then there's no go-around, right?
So they
no
had
touch
to,
and go.
So they had to be very close to the action where you launched this thing. So you had to get up into the forward area, and you're basically launching this thing from the forward area into occupied territory.
Correct.
And a lot of gliders were unable to find a smooth landing surface, and there was a lot of casualties on landing as well.
Wow. All right, cool, guys. This is a great conversation, and we're going to take a break here at the bottom of the hour, and we're going to come back to Miller Field on the fly. J-Mont G, you're listening to EAA Radio.